he goes and he starts to explain and teach fundamental misunderstandings that the Jews had allowed to creep into the law of God, right? Because in many cases, he just takes a piece of God's law and says, you're applying it the wrong way. He's not teaching something new per se, even though these might have been new or misunderstood at the time or new for the time. And so, you know, if you go and you turn to Matthew 5:38, in the sermon, Jesus proclaims, he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Right? Again, another very famous saying that, you know, whether you're Christian or not, many people would identify. And of course, you know, the opposite of turn the other cheek, the person who typically utters an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is the person who something, you know, wrong has been done to. So these are, you know, in many ways competing phrases that people use depending on their perspective, depending on what seat they're sitting in. And so before moving on to talk about the rest of Christ's teaching here, let's set the proper context of this law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, because it's very, you know, commonly misunderstood. And of course, it was a law that was given, you know, through Moses to the Israelites, right? And it was given by the Lord. So the one who was to become Jesus Christ was the one who uttered the words as well, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, or at least, you know, uttered them through Moses to the Israelites. So, you know, was Christ being inconsistent with himself? Was he, you know, had he seen what had happened to Israel throughout the years and figured out that he had made a mistake in giving the law an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth? You know, did he decide that it was kind of a brutal, a bloodthirsty law that wasn't proper anymore, and so he'd come to change it? You know, as we look through through the context of this law, we see that isn't the case, that Christ had come to fix a misunderstanding that the Jews had with this law. So this phrase, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is repeated three times in the Torah. So Exodus 21, 24, and 25, Deuteronomy 19, 21, and Leviticus 24, 17 through 22. So it wasn't just a phrase that, you know, God had thrown out to Moses as a, you know, passing phrase and wasn't something he really intended. It was one he actually repeated multiple times. And we'll read here in Leviticus. This is Leviticus 24, 17 through 22. We'll read the context of where it was given. It says in Exodus 21, verse 22, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according to the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But then it goes on, it says, but if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So, you know, there's much more to this phrase than just an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but this is what we focus on. And so what we see here, and we'll read some of this here, but this part of the law, and if you look at the other examples as well, it makes it very clear that what God is doing here is he's setting a maximum penalty for a range of law-breaking activities, right? And especially law-breaking activities that would cause retaliation from those or the family of those that had been injured. And we'll read quite a bit from Barclay's commentary, but I'll read just or quote just a little bit here. But Barclay's commentary says that this law is known as lex talionis, or the law of retaliation. And it goes on and it says that far from being a savage and bloodthirsty law, it is in fact the beginning of mercy, right? And you might think, well, you know, how does eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, why is that the beginning of mercy? But he goes on and explains that its original intent, its original aim, was the limitation of vengeance, right? Because that's what happened during that time. And there's really two historical contexts that are important to understand about why this law was so important and why it was, in fact, the beginning of mercy, not a bloodthirsty law. The first is that in that society and in that age in which the Israelites were in, one was judged very heavily by honor, right? So you defended your honor. You defended the honor of your family. You defended the honor of your tribe. You defended your honor of your nation. And it was this like circle that kept going out, and you would defend all of those circles that you were part of. And if there was any conflict, it was, you know, whatever circle was closest to you that you would defend its honor. You know, if you remember, only a few generations, 400 years or so before these Israelites were given this law, their forefathers, right, two of the sons of Israel, Simeon and Levi, killed Hamor and Shechem and all the males of a village because Shechem had gone in and to their sister and had defiled her. And of course, this was a sin, right? We know this is a sin, and God would call it a sin. But when we read the story, what we see is that Shechem was willing to do the right thing, right? He wanted to go and marry Dina, and was even willing to go so far as to have not just himself, but all the men of his village circumcised so that they would follow the customs of Israel. And again, if you think about this, this is an entire village that was willing to do this. So, you know, not just was Shechem willing to do the right thing. Again, he had sinned. He had done the wrong thing, but he's willing to make it right. He was willing to do the just thing. And so what we see here is that, you know, going kind of even above and beyond just marrying her, he was willing to follow the customs of the Israelites. And again, this would have been a big deal in that day because it would have been basically saying your customs are more important than our customs. And you know, I think if you think about it, again, not that he did the right thing, but this was how deep his love was for their sister, right? And should have been something that was recognized and acknowledged. But, you know, what happened, right? He you know, in this case was making right a sinful situation. And you could say in godly terms, justice was being done, right? Here was this woman who was, who was now going to marry the person that had defiled her. But Simeon and Levi were not driven by justice, and they certainly weren't driven by mercy, right? Because as I say, when you look at other parts of God's law, this would have been the exact right punishment, so to say, for the sin that had happened. He would have had to marry their sister. But they were driven not by justice and not by mercy, but by defending their family's honor, right? And this honor, right, not godly honor as we know, but some perverted sense of honor. You know, it's what's driven many famous feuds in the past, right? You know, think about the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? Think about whole wars like the War of the Roses in England that were driven entirely by defending the honor of your family, right? Thousands of people killed. You know, it's the honor that says that if you're hurt or if you're injured or even, you know, insulted or someone looks at you the wrong way, then you're going to come back and you're going to do something even worse to that person, right? Like you're going to get back at them and you're going to get back in a way that more than pays back what they've done. And it's the type of honor that causes this ever escalating situation, right? It can turn something fairly petty into something very serious. You know, if you read history of some of these famous feuds, a lot of them have started on pretty petty things, and then they end up getting, you know, people killed, sometimes thousands of people killed. And so we see that what Simeon and Levi were doing was not trying to get justice, was not definitely trying to show godly mercy. They were driven by revenging the name or the honor that had been taken away, so to speak, from their family. And of course, we know the story. They went in and they killed every male of the village, which was completely not proportional to what had happened. And definitely not when Shechem had responded in the way that he had done, where he was willing to marry their sister and to have their entire village follow the custom of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. The second important context of this law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is that, you know, this wasn't a focus of private citizens getting revenge for something that had been done to them. It wasn't about someone in a private, you know, from a private perspective, extracting vengeance. This was focused on judges to ensure that the judge handed out a penalty that was proportional to the crime or to the sin. You know, and especially if you read the history of that time, you know, many of the ancient laws gave very disproportionate punishments for crimes, and particularly for poor people. You know, it was very common that if you stole bread, then instead of having to pay back that bread, you would have your hand cut off, right? And of course, then you're in an even worse situation, because if you're already poor with two hands and now you only have one, there's much less work that you can do, right? Or even, you know, if you think about a lot of the laws, and this was also very common in the medieval period, you know, if someone poor or someone that was weaker than you or was in a lower station in your life injured somebody powerful, even accidentally, the penalty was death, right? So if you would, you know, strike a king, the penalty would be immediate death. And so there was this disproportionate punishments that judges would hand out, like I said, particularly for poor people. And so you have this law that sets the maximum penalty. And so, you know, the penalty was if you knocked out someone's tooth, the most that could be done to you was to have a tooth taken out, right? So it was ensured that there wasn't this ever escalating vengeance or response. And so, you know, as I say, in this context, the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth law was not there to, you know, maximize the punishment that was given out. It was actually to minimize it, to make sure that it was proportional to what had happened. And so, you know, it's much like today's law where, you know, for various crimes, there's maximum sentencing that can be handed out. And it's to ensure, you know, a fairly broad basis of commonality when it comes to punishing crimes. And so we look at it in that sense. It's very different than a bloodthirsty law. It's very different than a harsh crime or a harsh law, harsh punishment. It's actually one that was there to prevent this escalation that was very common in the world at the time and even the world today. And so coming back now to Christ's law, or Christ's teaching on this law of retaliation, you know, the Jews at the time of Christ were still very much living in a society driven by honor. And so he had to come back and he had to explain the real purpose of the law of Moses. Because when we look at other parts of the Gospels and the interactions the apostles had with the Jews of the day, they would have viewed this as something to maximize the amount of vengeance they could get, right? Instead of minimizing the amount of vengeance, they would have been pushing to get, you know, every little bit of vengeance out of it. You know, they would have been, well, if you knocked off my front tooth, I want to knock off the same front tooth that's the biggest of yours, right? Now, it's not just the tooth is enough. It has to be the exact one. And maybe if my teeth are bigger than yours, then we should measure them and knock off the, you know, a portion of another tooth. Like, I want to maximize the vengeance that I get. And so this is the society that Christ was talking to, was they had twisted God's law, a law that was intended to minimize vengeance, a law that was intended to, you know, bring down the heat in these situations. They were using it to maximize what they were able to do. And so it's a very different, you know, time and place that he was entering and he was talking about this law. You know, because as I say, you know, we read other places where, you know, the Jews were, you know, using this eye for an eye and tooth for tooth not to seek justice and mercy. They were really there to just maximize the punishment they could give. And so by starting this section with the law about eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, Christ is setting the context of what he's talking about. And he's setting it in a legal sense. He's saying when you come into a situation where eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth might apply, here's what you should do instead as a Christian. And so we have to understand that context to then now dive in to what Christ is really teaching. You know, so, you know, in today's English, he might have started off with something like this. You might have heard you have these rights, right? We're all about rights today. You might have heard you have these rights to expect retribution to some degree of wrong done to you, right? That's kind of what he's saying. You know the law. You know what your rights within the laws are. And so you know this. Now I'm going to tell you what you should think about your rights as a Christian. And so he goes on and he says in Matthew 5:39, so coming back to this section of scriptures, he says, "But I tell you not to resist an evil person." And this resist comes from the Greek Strong's word, which is G436. It's anthestium. And it means to stand against or to oppose, to resist, to withstand. So it gives you some sense of what Christ is saying. He says, but I tell you not to stand up against an evil person. I tell you not to withstand them. Some other kind of biblical usage that gives a sense, it would be to stand oneself against, you know, in this case, against an evil person, to resist, to oppose this evil person. So he's saying, I tell you not to stand against an evil person. You shouldn't resist against that person. But he's saying it in the context of these three examples that he goes on to give, right? And when you think of, you know, aligning this with eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, he's basically saying, when someone has done you wrong as a Christian, you're not to stand up against them. You have a different perspective that you're to give. You know, you're not supposed to retaliate just because they did you wrong. So then he goes on and gives these three examples of where they apply. And each of these three examples give us a different sense of the type of wrongs that could happen to us and how we're to respond. So the first one is, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. And of course, you know, people might look at it and say, well, you know, if someone hits you, don't hit him back. Or, you know, if someone hits you, let him hit you again. And that's not what Christ is actually talking about at all. Because, again, we have to understand the historical context of what he's saying. And, you know, I think an interesting thing here is when he specifies, do not hit on the right cheek. So does it mean if they hit you on the left cheek, like you're free to like go in and do whatever you want? No, he's actually talking about a specific context in that time period. And I'll read here from Barclay's because it gives us this context. So this is Barclay, and he says, suppose a right-handed man is standing in front of another man, and suppose he wants to slap the other man on the right cheek. How does he do it? Right? He can't go like that. I mean, he could kind of like twist it or something like that, but it would be a backhanded slap, right? And it goes on, so it says, unless he goes through the most complicated contortions and unless he empties the blow of all force, he can hit the other man's cheek only in one way, with the back of his hand. Now, why would that be important? Right? Because that doesn't make much sense for us today, right? If you get slapped, you know, with the palm of the hand or your back of the hand, it's about the same. I wouldn't think of it as being any different. But what Barclay goes on and says, he says, now, according to Jewish rabbinic law, to hit a man with the back of the hand was twice as insulting. Note this, insulting. It's not about harming someone. It's not about hurting that person. It's not like punching their lights out, it's about insulting the person. So it's twice as insulting to have hit him than with the flat of the hand. So what Jesus is saying is, even if someone should direct at you the most deadly and calculated insult, you must on no account retaliate. You must on no account resent it. Right? So it's a very different concept than what we would in our society think. So basically, you know, what Christ is saying here is that, you know, however in your society, and it changes from society to society, you're insulted, you are not to retaliate in like manner to another person. You're not to insult them back. And again, here he's very specific in saying, you know, if you're hit with the back of a hand because it's twice as insulting as with the palm of the hand, you're not to retaliate. So no matter how bad that insult is, you don't retaliate back. And again, this isn't, you know, if someone punches you and you're physically in danger, you don't stop that person from punching you again. Or it's not talking about physical harm, because that wasn't the intent of the slap at the time, or this particular slap. This slap was meant to insult you. You know, I mean, this would be the equivalent of insulting someone on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or, you know, wherever you're insulted. That was the goal. Right. And we see in various places that or various time periods that, you know, the slap would what? Turn into a duel. The duel would then lead to two people shooting at each other, right? We in fact had one vice president, you know, sitting vice president, shoot a former secretary of treasury because they had started, you know, basically in very, very similar ways, being Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. You know, they got into a duel because they had basically been insulting each other, and it ended up being that Alexander Hamilton was killed, was shot. And this is what Christ is saying we as Christians are supposed to prevent. Right, we are not to trade insults with other people. This isn't, as I say, anything about physical violence. This is about insults that are being traded back and forth. And going back, you know, if you think about this distorted concept of honor that I was talking about, you know, these insults, as I said, would often lead to physical violence. And so what we are told as Christians are we are not to trade insults in such a way that it would lead to escalations over time. We are just to take those insults. We're not to insult back. And it's hard, right? No one likes to be insulted. No one wants to be made fun of. No one wants, you know, to have someone else, you know, get the better of them, especially in very public ways. And a lot of these, and you know, in this case, these slaps would be public insults. You know, you would go up to someone, you know, imagine, you know, you're a businessman and you're in the middle of your business. What would someone do if they wanted to insult you? They would come up right in the middle of when you're doing business and they would make a very public display of this. And if you think about society today, this is very common, right? We trade insults in very public ways. You know, how often, as I was reading this, how often do we see you know, I don't even pay attention to it very much. And I see all the time these articles about this famous person got a good slam on this other person, probably not famous, that said something mean about him. Like, this happens all the time. Like, this is just our society. We don't let insults just slide. We have to respond. And this is exactly what Christ is saying as Christians, we can't do. We have to just let it slide. And we know why, right? We see in Proverbs, it says, "Do not say, 'I will recompense evil.' Wait for the Lord and he will save you." Because all of these things, when we just let these insults, when we let these evil things said about us just go, God is taking account of them and he will make it right. He will make it happen. And so, you know, we think about it in this, you know, distorted concept of honor. We're not allowing God to do what he says he's going to do. Because what does he say? He says he's going to bring us up to honor. Well, if we're out there defending our honor all the time, can he bring us up to honor? He can't, because we're not letting him. But what does he say? He'll cut down our pride. And isn't it our pride that prevents us from letting our honor go? Right? You think about this. This is exactly the opposite of what Christ is telling us to do throughout scriptures. We're to look to him to honor us, not our own selves honoring ourselves by defending this distorted view of honor. And so, you know, as I say, especially when you look at our society today, this is just the exact opposite of what we see. No one will let any insult go. You have to respond to anything and everything, no matter how small, minor, big, whatever. And here Christ is saying, even the biggest, most public insult that can happen to you, you just don't respond. You say, okay, I'll let you insult me again. Again, this isn't physical hitting. This is, I'm going to insult you, in a big major way, and so you just take it and you let him insult you again. This is what Christ is saying. And again, does this mean we're not to respond at all? It's not. It's interesting that Christ himself was actually in this exact same situation. So he was struck. We'll read this in John 18:19, and we'll see how he handled it. Because he wasn't completely quiet, but he also didn't trade insults. It says in John 18:19, it says, "The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciple and his doctrine. Jesus answered him and said, 'I spoke openly to the world. I also taught in the synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always met. And in secret, I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I have said to them. Indeed, they know what I said.'" And again, if you think about who he was talking to, because this was, you know, when they had brought him before the high priest, there were likely many of those Pharisees that had come and questioned him time and time again, and he always responded to them. So there would have been, you know, people in this crowd that had not only heard him speak, but had questioned him in a way to try to get him into trouble. So this is, you know, a pretty straightforward. It'd been like, why are you asking me when you can, you know, ask John Murphy what I said, or, you know, Trent Carlson or whoever, like people that are hearing what I'm saying, like those people are here, you know, you ask them. But then what does it go on and say in 18 verse 22? It says, "And when he said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, 'Do you answer the high priest like that?'" This was an insult, right? You know, I don't know the equivalent today, but you know, this officer was insulting Christ and was doing it because he thought he was not giving enough deference to the high priest. And how did Jesus respond? Jesus didn't respond with insults, but he also didn't respond with nothing, right? He didn't just stay silent. You see what he said. "Jesus answered him, 'If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil.'" You just heard what I said. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't, you know, saying anything mean or evil to the high priest. I answered him truthfully. He says, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" And so, you know, again, this is an example. It's not that we have to always remain silent, but we can't trade insults. You know, it's perfectly reasonable to say, you know, "What have I done to you? Like, why would you say that mean thing to me? I don't understand. Help me understand." And this is what Christ is doing. You know, so again, the response, it's not that you can't say anything. It's not that you can't respond. But the response can't be an insult back. It can't be vile or evil response in return. And that's what Christ is showing us. You know, as I said, it's very interesting that he, at the beginning of his ministry, gave this teaching specifically about being struck. And then at the end of his life, he is in this situation and he shows us how we are to respond, if we respond at all. And of course, you know, it takes wisdom to know how to respond. We know when we read the Proverbs, right, there's a time to answer and there's the time to not say anything at all. Right? Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Right? And unfortunately, that takes a lot more wisdom than we might have at any given time, as our, you know, as our blood pressure goes up and the adrenaline is rushing in. But this is what we see from Christ. This is what we see from the Proverbs, that, you know, if someone insults you, sometimes it's just best to say nothing, just walk away, leave it be. And then sometimes there's a time to answer, but you never answer in an evil way. You answer, you know, trying to better understand the situation. So that's example one. And it's very, I think, relevant to our time, our society today, especially over the last, you know, maybe 10, 15 years, if things have progressively gotten worse and worse. And you see this macro, you know, escalation of vengeance, right? Where someone says something bad about you, about your family, about your tribe, about the, you know, party you're in, about your football team, about whatever you feel close to, you have to respond. You have to get back. You have to get your dig in to them. So let's look at example two. This is in Matthew 5:40. It says, "If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also." So I don't know how many, show of hands, be honest, how many people have a tunic? Probably more people have a cloak, right? A few people out there? Ooh, I don't see any hands. Okay, so no one has a cloak or a tunic. So this might not make a lot of sense to you. But again, I want to go back to Barclay and read what Barclay says, because it puts us in context where we can then apply it to our lives today. Here in Barclay, it says, "The tunic was a long sack-like inner garment made of cotton or of linen. Even the poorest man would have had changes of a tunic. The cloak was a great blanket-like outer garment which the man wore as a robe by day and used as a blanket at night. So it would have been very valuable, and he only had one. Of such garments, a Jew would have only had one. Now, it was actually the Jewish law that a man's tunic might be taken as a pledge, but not his cloak. It says here in Exodus 22, 26 through 27, "If you take your neighbor's cloak in pawn, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down, because he will be very cold if you don't give him his blanket. It says, you shall, for it may be your neighbor's only clothing to use as cover. In what else shall that person sleep?" The point is that by right, so the person's right, a man's cloak could not be taken permanently from him. So again, this is a right that was established in the Mosaic Law. They couldn't have their cloak taken away from them overnight. So what is Christ saying here? You know, Christ is saying that we should not be so focused on our rights when it comes to, you know, the lightest of slights or infringements on those rights. He's saying we should focus on our Christian duty. We should focus on our responsibility, especially when it comes to de-escalating situations. Because remember the context of the section. It's about retaliation for either real or perceived wrongs. And when would you go sue somebody? You would sue them when you had a perceived wrong. So in this case, someone else perceived that you had done the wrong thing to them, and so they're gonna sue you. And what it's saying is that, you know, you shouldn't defend your honor. Because what's going to happen when somebody sues you? You're going to think you didn't do the wrong thing. You're going to try to defend your honor. You're going to try to make, you know, your name good again. But here Christ is saying, look at it a different way. If someone comes and sues you, if someone comes and, you know, says that you did them the wrong thing, and in this case, you know, you had, and basically the situation is you had given your tunic as a pawn for what they did. They had the right to take your tunic away and keep it. And what he's saying is go beyond that to make the situation right. Even though it's your right, you have the right of law behind you to say, okay, I'm only giving your tunic, give them your cloak as well. And that is something of great value. You know, you would have been in a bad situation as soon as the night came, and it might be many nights before you can afford a new cloak. And so it's saying, put yourself kind of in a harmful way, or, you know, put yourself to have some kind of, you know, harm, you know, maybe not complete harm, but still you're harming yourself so that you're not defending your honor. You're making the situation de-escalate. You're not, you know, having them sue you and then you insult them and then they slap you with the back of their hand and then you, you know, challenge them to a duel and then one of you kill each other. And that's what he's saying here, right? He's saying before it even gets to that, even if it's harmful for you, you let it happen. You don't just cling to your rights just because they're, you know, prescribed in the law. You do the right thing and you de-escalate the situation as a Christian. So it's the same kind of context that we see. Now, does this mean that you should never use your rights? That's not, again, what Christ is saying here. But it is, you know, if you look at a couple examples, it is similar to what Paul teaches and then an example that we see with Paul. So in the first situation, or the first teaching, Paul comes in Corinthians 6, and we'll read 6:1 for a little bit of context, and then 1 Corinthians 6:7, it says, Paul says, dare any of you, having a matter against one another, go to the law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? We all know this. But what does he say at the end? He says in 1 Corinthians 6:7, now therefore, it is already an utter failure for you to go to the law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? See, this is what Christ is saying. He said, accept the wrong. Why do you not rather let yourself be cheated? No, you yourself do wrong and cheat, and you do these things to your brethren. He's saying, we as Christians have a right to just sometimes let the wrong thing happen to us. Because again, what's going to happen? They're not forgotten. You don't just have wrong done to you and they're forgotten. We actually have a promise that says God is remembering everything that happened to you, every wrong, and he will be the one to make it right. And God can make it right much better than we can make it right. You know, the way that God's going to make it right is much more powerful, much more lasting than the way we can make it right. And this is what Paul and Christ are talking about. But again, you know, it's not that we give up every right that we have, because we also know that Paul himself, you know, invoked his right as a Roman citizen to go to Caesar. This is Acts 25:9-12, if you want to jot that down. And I probably won't read the whole thing, but we know the story, right? He's taken before Festus, and Festus is, you know, talking to the Jews, and he answered Paul and he says, you know, why don't you go to Jerusalem and have these things judged? And by this time, you know, the sense is that Festus is like, okay, yeah, Paul's not doing, you know, Paul didn't do anything wrong against the law. So I'm going to take him to Jerusalem, have a trial, but he's going to go free. But what did Paul respond? He says, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. Right? So he invoked the right he had as a Roman citizen. So again, Christ in this teaching isn't saying that we never invoke the rights that were given by the government. But it does say, you know, in matters where, especially where it's, you know, one-on-one, more personal, ought to be willing to have harm done to us, even if we might be in the right, because we're de-escalating a situation. We're causing retaliation not to happen. Right? And if you think about it, the main difference in these cases is that Paul is not invoking his right for his own personal honor. Again, going back to this concept that the Israelites had and the Jews had, and we still very much have today, that we're out there defending our personal honor. Right? Paul was defending what? Paul was defending the gospel message. Because what the Jews were saying is that by preaching the gospel message, you are breaking the law. And so when he invoked this right, it wasn't because it was to restore his personal honor, or he thought he could have his personal honor restored by Caesar. He was invoking his rights so that the gospel message could be preached in Israel and in Judah and in the rest of the Roman Empire. So it's very much him not invoking the right for his own personal benefit, but so that he could preach the gospel of God, the gospel of Jesus Christ. So let's move on to example 3. This is in Matthew 5:41, and it says, and whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. And so I'll read just again a little bit of context here. So what Jesus was saying is, suppose your masters come to you and compel you to be a guide or a porter for a mile. That was very common, and especially the Roman army could compel any Jew at the time to come and carry their backpack, carry their weapons for a mile. It goes on, it says, don't do a mile with bitter and obvious resentment. Go 2 miles with cheerfulness and with a good grace. What Jesus is saying is, don't be always thinking of your liberty to do as you like. Be always thinking of your duty and your privilege to be of service to others. When a task is laid on you, even if the task is unreasonable and hateful, don't do it as a grim duty to be resented. Do it as a service to be gladly rendered. And again, if you think about this, Christ is ultimately talking about a matter of honor, right? Because think of what this was to the Jews. They hated the Romans. They hated the fact that the Roman army was there. If it wasn't for the Roman army, they would have had a nation of their own, right? They would have been a kingdom in and of themselves. And not just that, but from a personal perspective, how much do you hate somebody coming in and, you know, unjustly telling you to do something and compelling you to do that thing? You know, we all, right, our natural reaction is to say no. Even if it's reasonable, we want to say no. And so here, you know, we can easily get self-righteous. We can easily say that this infringes on our personal rights, our personal freedoms, our time, or, you know, whatever it is. And like I said, at the time, this struck at the national pride of the Jews, right? To have to serve the Romans in this way. So, you know, not only was this a personal hurt or a personal ding on your honor, it was also a ding on the national honor. And so Christ, though, is telling you, is even if it's like this, don't just do the minimum. Go beyond what you may be compelled by law to do, because that was the law, right? They could compel you to go for a mile. They couldn't compel you to go for, you know, a mile and a half. And so this is saying, you know, almost the opposite of the other one where you're trying to take your rights to the very maximum. This is saying, you know, go beyond what the law says you actually have to do and do it cheerfully. Because again, in this case, you are to be, as a Christian, of a different spirit, right? And this is not a spirit of weakness, which it's often viewed as, right? When you, you know, don't respond to insults, when you, you know, give up something, you know, when you're being sued or when you have some injury and you say, okay, like, here's even more to make it right, or when you're told to do something you don't want to do, you know, you're going to always do the minimum. If you do anything else, you're viewed as weak. You're viewed as, you know, all kinds of bad words. But here, the spirit we're called is to be a spirit that trusts and relies on God to lift you up from shame to honor, because that is what God says he'll do. And if we have faith in him, if we have trust in him, if we're patient, if we don't take it on our own time, but the time that God views, then he will lift us up. He will remember all of these wrongs that were done to you, and he will personally make them right. That's his promise to us. But when we go in and we try to make them right on our own, what happens? It's almost always a circle, or, you know, a downward spiral of things going worse and worse and worse. And that's what we see in society today. You know, how much better would society be if instead of responding to every, you know, slight or insult that happens, if people just let it happen, you know, didn't respond, or even better, as Christ did, try to understand why that person is insulting them. Now, that's not the way we do it today, or it's not the way society generally does it. You know, how much better would it be if someone thinks you've done the wrong thing to them, as opposed to arguing them and proving your point of why you didn't do something wrong to them? You said, okay, and let me make up for it even more. Let me give you even a little bit more. And how much better would society be if, when we were compelled to do something, we didn't, you know, argue and try to be as miserable as we can and try to do as little as we can, but say, oh, if you need me to walk a mile, I'll go 2 miles, because if you needed me to walk a mile, surely it would make it even better if I walked 2. And this is what Christ is telling us, right? This is what Christ is teaching us, is that he's saying, don't worry about your honor. Yeah, people will think less of you, absolutely, but who do you want to honor you? Do you want other people to honor you? Do you want to have to constantly defend your own honor? Or do you want me to lift you up from this shame that you have with other people, and I will honor you? This is what God is saying. And again, this is a very foreign concept. Even in mainstream Christianity, moving away from these teachings. You know, how often are we seeing over the last, you know, 7, 8, 12 years, where even, you know, Christian preachers are hitting back whenever they're insulted, right? This is not what we're called to do. And again, this isn't meant for us to be passive. You know, think about some of the examples that we have. Think about Joseph, right? He was sold into slavery. Again, a harm was done to him. His honor, you know, he went from a free person who was held in highest honor by his father to sold as a slave. But what did he do? You know, after after Israel died, the brothers were afraid. And how did he respond to them? You know, by, you know, the law of tooth for tooth, eye for an eye, he probably could have gotten away with selling them all into slavery. But what did he say? This is in Genesis 50:19. He says, Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for I am in the place of God." Or, "For am I in the place of God?" Right? He's acknowledging God is the one that was going to take vengeance if any needed to happen in that case. He says, "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about it, or in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid." And this is the important part. What does he do? He doesn't just say, "Don't be afraid, I won't kill you." Right? Like, if you go far enough away, I won't come and search for you. He says, "I will provide for you and your little ones." Think how much that's similar to the example of the cloak and the tunic, right? I could get this, but I'm going to go well beyond to make it you understand how much I love you, how much I'm willing to forgive what you've done, right? He was going way beyond what he had to do. And he acknowledged and gave it up to God for any type of vengeance that would be done in that matter. You know, or think about David and Saul, right? David was hunted for something that he didn't even do. He loved Jonathan. He was willing to serve Saul as long as God wanted him to serve Saul. He knew he was going to be king, but he wasn't doing anything to speed up the process. But of course, Saul wanted to kill him. Saul was jealous of him. And twice, he had the chance to kill Saul. He had the chance to take vengeance. And again, in the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth law, if you go to the maximum penalty, Saul was trying to kill him, so he would have been justified in killing Saul. But we know David had a very different heart, a very different outlook. So much so that, you know, when he did such a thing as cutting the corner off Saul's robe, which had a fairly big statement in that way, in that time period. So it wasn't, you know, just like cut a little piece of cloth off of you. It there was some symbolism there. But even when he did that, what did he do immediately after? It says, "Now it happened afterward, David's heart was troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe." So even though he hadn't gone up to the maximum vengeance that he was allowed to by the law, he was troubled that he had taken any vengeance at all. He knew he did the wrong thing. And he says, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." Right? David had learned this lesson that Christ was having to reteach the Jews at the time when he came. He knew that vengeance wasn't his. He knew he wasn't supposed to escalate the situation. He was supposed to de-escalate it. You know, and if you remember, right, he comes out at the end of one of these and he says, you know, "Saul, I could have killed you." And what does Saul do after that? It says Saul went away and left him alone. David de-escalated the situation, and he wasn't back in Saul's good graces, but at least Saul wasn't trying to actively kill him. You know, David knew what Christ had to reteach the Pharisees. And so now going back at the end of this, Christ then ends his teaching, I think, in a little bit of a curious way at first glance. You know, this whole section has been about how Christians are to respond to hurts and grievances, how we're, you know, not to go beyond kind of the maximum of the law. We're trying to minimize and de-escalate the situation, how we're to take hurts, how we're to take insults, you know, how we're to go beyond just the bare minimum to settle disputes, even if it requires us to lose more than our rights say we should lose, you know, that we are to, you know, work for other people, even if that's somewhat unjust in the things that we're required to do. But he ends this section by saying in Matthew 5:42, it says, "Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." Now, how are those things related? And on the first glance, you know, the first one is all about, or the first three examples are all about, you know, the law and matters of the law and how you to respond when negative things happen, right? And here it ends, but it says, in addition to all these things, when someone asks for something, give it to them. Again, this notion of, you know, go beyond what's expected of you. Go beyond what the bare minimum of the law says, right? Because nowhere in the law does it say we, you know, have to give something to someone else. It's our thing. It's ours, right? The law says it's yours, so you can keep it and do with it what you want. But Christ is saying, even in this, you know, go beyond what the law is required of you. And it's interesting because at the end of this, this one as well actually turns back and looks at another law in the Old Testament. So it begins with eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. And then in this statement, he points back to a section of law in Deuteronomy 15:7-11. And I'll read it here quickly. It says, Deuteronomy 15:7-11, "If there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your hearts nor shut your hand from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his needs, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, 'The seventh year, the year of release, is at hand.'" So again, he's actually pointing back to a law, right? And we know this law. What happened? Someone would borrow something from you. You would give it to them, maybe land or something else, and you could take payment for it. But then in that seventh year, or sorry, the opposite. If someone sold you, let's say, a piece of land, then in that seventh year, you had to give it back, right? So what would likely happen there at the very end? Like, you wouldn't want to give very much money for something because you're not going to have it very long. Or if you sold it to them, you know, you would get it back. But here, you know, God is telling the Israelites, he says, even in that seventh year, you know, if your brother is poor, help him out. You know, don't think about it just because you're not going to get as much in return. So it goes on and it says, "And your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you." Again, the same concept. Don't worry about your honor. Don't worry about those things that you have. Don't try to defend what you have. Don't try to keep, hold on, hang on to those things, because it's God who will remember. It's God who will pay you back. Right? When you let someone insult you and don't respond in kind, when you're willing to defuse a situation by giving more than what's absolutely, you know, required, when you're willing to go beyond and help somebody out more than the minimum of the law, God is saying, "I will remember it and I will pay you back." In this case, God becomes in your debt, right? God has said he's there. He's going to stand up and pay for any hurt that you might have received. So it's a very powerful statement that we see here. It says, "For this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor and your needy in your land." Now this is such a beautiful part of the Old Testament because it so clearly lays out, you know, what Christ comes back and talks about: love, mercy, justice. Right, these things from the very beginning were the foundation of the law of Moses. Right, we even see in the eye for an eye and tooth for tooth that the intent was love, mercy, and justice. Right, that was the intent. It was to de-escalate things, make things less likely to escalate, make it so that people wouldn't take vengeance way beyond what they should. That it was turned over to matter to the judges to take care of, and that you wouldn't personally go take vengeance for things. And we see, you know, the story of Simeon and and Levi how, you know, what happened when they took matters into their own hands, how much things can escalate. And we see it around us today. All the time, people aren't willing to go beyond, aren't willing to obey these commands of Christ because it's hard, right? Our honor is ours, right? Like, we don't want to give it up. And if we start giving it up, it's really hard to get back, right? We can't get it back. But that's not what God is calling us to do. God is calling us to be different. God is calling on us to trust Him, to hand it over to Him, let Him work it out in the time that He decides. And so here, in just these few verses, you know, Christ gives us such a powerful view of how Christians are called to be different, to show a different spirit than those around us. And think how powerful of a statement acting in this way would have. It would be completely different than almost everyone else in society. Now, people would view you as weak. People would view you as not defending your honor, absolutely. But it would show them a different way. It would show them the way of God, how we are to be different, how we aren't to maximize the retaliation that we do when someone does us harm. And so, brethren, you know, as we live in this society, as we look around all of those things that happen to us, let's remember what Christ taught us here with the proper meaning and the proper understanding of an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Let's remember how much we as Christians are called to, you know, do things that are hard, do things that are against our nature, that we are to, you know, minimize vengeance that we give. We aren't to be vengeful for those things that are done. We aren't to try to defend our honor, but we're rather called to look to God, to rely on God as the one who will lift us up and ultimately honor us in the world to come.